Some people here might disagree with the view that ritual studies can or should aim at general theories. It certainly is possible that the field could progress usefully in the following way. One person describes a particular ritual culture, citing ethnographic or historical evidence, and perhaps proposing ad hoc explanations or conclusions derived from those data. Other people listen and perhaps take away some lesson that they can use in their own research, but everybody may derive a different takeaway. In such a situation, we could say, in the language of Plato, that studying ritual is a matter of art rather than knowledge. The ability to give a practitioner's account rather than an account of the way things are. Such a view would be consistent with the skeptical epistemology that's so common in academia today, and I don't intend to argue against such an approach to ritual. However, this minimalistic approach to theory is not one that I follow. This doesn't mean that I feel the need to go so far in the other direction as to argue that ritual is a distinct type of thing. That's the kind of view that Catherine Bell has argued against so strongly. I think many people who study ritual would agree that some midpoint between these extremes is acceptable. And in the midpoint, we'd probably agree that some general account of ritual is desirable. This would allow us to learn more systematically from each other, and would allow us to be working on some common project, rather than all working on our own projects, and hoping to take some inchoate inspiration from one another's work. But a general theory of ritual is still a desideratum. If most of us can agree that some kind of general theory is desirable, then why have we had so much difficulty achieving it? Part of the answer, no doubt, is that most general theories come out of the analysis of a particular ritual culture. Most good ones, at any rate, since the day of armchair theorizing is over. And it's always tough, when trying to understand contingent facts in situ, to pull apart general and specific causes. This is a deep methodological problem, which in a short paper I can only begin to approach by means of examples. Let me therefore focus on one general theory of ritual, that of Humphrey and Laidlaw. And let me focus on a key aspect of their theory, namely the view that ritual is a mode by which, quote, the identity of a ritualized act does not depend, as in the case with normal action, on the agent's intention in acting. The idea is this. In the case of everyday mundane actions, what I'm doing is determined by my intention in acting. Humphrey and Laidlaw give the example of the policeman telling the ice skater, "The ice is thin over there." The policeman means to warn the skater that he could be in danger, but the statement is only a warning because that's how the policeman intends his utterance. It doesn't come directly from the language of the statement, and we could envision situations where the same sentence is not used as a warning at all. If we were preparing ice for use in carving, for example, and we needed a certain minimum thickness, the sentence would simply communicate that we had not yet waited long enough for all the ice to form. Humphrey and Laidlaw argue that ritual action is stipulated. That's a technical term. Once a person decides to perform a ritual in the context of a particular ritual culture, then there are rules within that culture that stipulate what she has to do. From this it follows that one of the most common ways of understanding ritual is misguided, namely, the view of ritual as symbolic communication. Ritual is not malleable like natural language, allowing the officiant to express particular ideas through the manipulation of symbols. Consider three Janes waving a lamp before an idol, a ritual known as dip puja. Ask them what they're doing, or what they intend to accomplish in waving the lamp. One might say, offering the lamp to the idol, the second, shedding light on the idol, and the third, shedding light on myself. These are all interpretations that Humphrey and Laidlaw were offered by informants. Regardless, all three are performing dip puja, because in their ritual culture, waving a lamp before an idol just is performing dip puja, and the gloss or interpretation given by the performer doesn't change that. Contrast this with the case of the policeman. His utterance is a warning only if he intends to warn, and something else otherwise. What I'd like to do in this paper is look at some interesting examples of how Humphrey and Laidlaw's theory has been received in the ritual studies literature, and try to identify some of the problems that interfere with the development of general theory as we move from the culture from which the theory derived to other perhaps very different, ritual cultures. I'll summarize, briefly, three papers that I think are illustrative of what we'd find from a more thorough survey of scholarly practice, and which, in various ways, are quite good papers. We wouldn't learn much, after all, from looking at poor scholarship. I've picked two papers that examine Islamic ritual, by Henkel and Gade, and one with an African focus, by McIntosh. Full bibliographic references are given at the end of the handout. We can talk later about how I chose my examples, if you're skeptical that they aren't sufficiently representative. Or we can discuss another observation that I'll make now, parenthetically. Namely, that Islamicists seem to have been drawn to Humphrey and Laidlaw's theory well beyond their representation in the ritual studies literature.